Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Kevin, let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
Okay, today on the show, we have Dr. John Hunter, the chair of surgery at OHSU. He's going to be talking to us about the World Journal of Surgery, being an editor of that. And he's also going to talk about the surgical management of GERD. We're also going to learn a little bit about Oktoberfest today. And for the tips and tricks, Dr. Hunter is going to take us through mediastinal bleeding. But first, our opening shot.
Okay, for today's opening shot, we're going to be doing a quick review of GERD. We'll be going more in detail a little later with Dr. Hunter. But just as a general review, John, so talking about GERD, we talk about typical symptoms and we talk about atypical symptoms. Can you run through those real quick?
Yeah, Jason. For the typical symptoms, we usually think of heartburn, regurgitation, dysphagia. And for the atypical symptoms, we usually think of chronic cough, asthma, hoarseness, and non-cardiac chest pain.
So, Kevin, when a patient comes to you and they have some of these typical symptoms of, or typical or atypical symptoms, how do we go about nailing down the diagnosis?
Yeah, well, as always, it starts with a very thorough history and physical. A lot of times you can nail this down based on their symptoms that you can just learn through history and physical.
Well, how do you confirm it then?
Well, the first thing generally people do is, depends on institution, but you start off with an EGD, and you'll see, you know, inflammation at the GE junction, and you can get biopsies there, and that'll be your first step to diagnosing GERD.
Yeah, sometimes, a lot of times you'll see the esophagitis, the erosions, ulcers, or the on biopsy you'll see the columnar lined esophagus. But what do you do if the EGD is normal and you don't really see anything?
Yeah, sometimes they won't have mucosal changes, and that's when you'd want a confirmatory test with the pH testing, the pH probe that they put down and leave there for 24 hours. And this is considered the gold standard for GERD diagnosis.
A lot of times they often ask, you know, this correlates with the Demeester score, which I won't go through, but it has to do with, you know, the number of reflex episodes and the amount of time in different positions that the pH is less than 4. Generally, Demeester score greater than about 14.7 is indicative of gastroesophageal reflux. And of course, it's important also to rule out other things that, you know, cardiac chest pain that can be causing the similar symptoms when you're doing this. What patients would you consider getting a barium swallow in?
So patients that have dysphagia, these would be the first group. And then anyone that I would suspect a stricture in or a paraesophageal hernia, these would be the main group of people.
All right. So, John, we've made our diagnosis. How do we go about attempting medical management in these patients?
So the first thing we do with these patients is lifestyle modifications. And these usually present, the patients who have mild to intermittent symptoms. If they're having GERD at night, then you want to elevate the head of the bed. For, you know, things they can do throughout the day, avoid tight clothing, eat small, frequent meals, avoid eating meals just before going to bed. Weight loss is always a great way to reduce your GERD. And then avoid things that might exacerbate your GERD, including alcohol, coffee, chocolate, and mints.
Yeah, so I mean, we say that all the time, lifestyle modification, but often, I mean, these patients all end up on medication. So Kevin, what kind of medications do these patients often end up on?
I just say I could not undergo any of those lifestyle modifications myself, yeah, so I would switch straight to the medical therapy or the surgical therapy, as we'll get to. But nowadays, the gold standard is everyone is trialed on a PPI.
Yeah, or the H2 blockers are also pretty effective, and we won't get into the weeds as far as the physiology of acid secretion in the stomach, but it's certainly something all the residents and med students out there should review.
That mechanism is always on the ab site.
Every year. And most of these patients, you can get pretty good control with these medications, but unfortunately when patients come off the medications, the vast majority of them do have recurrence of their symptoms. So getting more into the surgical side of things, John, what are some of the goals of surgical interventions?
So when we talk about managing GERD, the overall goal is to establish an effective LES pressure, lower esophageal pressure. If we do this, it's curative in about 85 to 93% of the patients.
What are some of the indications for surgery, John?
So the indications we think of is a failure of intensive medical therapy. So they tried the medical management, it didn't work out for them. Recurrent symptoms immediately after stopping medications. Patients with atypical symptoms who have a good response to a trial of medical therapy. And obviously patients with Barrett's esophagus or an esophageal stricture.
Yeah, it seems like kind of contradictory there. You want patients that fail medical management, but you also want patients that respond well to medical management, and that has a lot to do with the prognosis. One of the most effective prognostic indicators for somebody who's going to do well with the surgery is that they actually responded well to the PPI or the H2 blocker, but for whatever reason, be it financial or other reason, they just don't want to take the medications for the rest of their life.
Yeah, and it's important to remember that PPIs don't come without risks. More and more data is coming out as we're putting people on PPIs for life, that there may be some risk factors, and some of them they're bringing up, it might be a cardiac risk factor.
Yeah, we'll get into that a little bit more later with Dr. Hunter as well. And other considerations you have to take into effect is some patients are non-compliant with the drug regimen. Like I said, there's a financial burden associated with these medications that can be quite expensive. And some patients, young patients, just don't want to take a medication for the rest of their life. When you're thinking about your sicker patients who have coagulopathies, maybe are older, have other comorbidities, these are the patients you want to think about may do better with medical management. So moving on, Kevin, so you're counseling or you're getting somebody tuned up for surgery. What are some of the preoperative tests that you want to order?
Right. So generally in this workup, they've already had their history and physical, and they've had their EGD. And so the one test you really want to get is an esophageal manometry before you give someone a wrap.
And why is that?
This allows you to evaluate the lower esophageal sphincter and make sure this is truly the reason and there's not any other esophageal dysmotility disorders that would be skewing the picture.
So when we talk about our different surgeries, our surgical options, there's three big ones that are often described, Kevin. And what are those?
Yeah, so the one that is performed most commonly is the Nissen, and that's the full 360-degree wrap from the posterior and wraps around and connects in front to the anterior. Sutures are in the anterior. Mm. And then you have the toupee, which is a 270-degree wrap. It's kind of the middle ground, and this one goes, like we said, 270 degrees, but also a posterior wrap with the sutures on the anterior side of the esophagus. And then the DOR fund application, D-O-R, is a 180-degree wrap, and this is the anterior wrap. So you're kind of covering the esophagus with the fundus of the stomach.
Yeah, and a way I remember that is a toupee. It goes on the back of your head, so it's a posterior wrap. And then, of course, you shut the front door, so that's the front anterior wrap with the DOR. There's a few other, kind of less talked about ones. What are those?
So those ones would be your Belzy wrap, which is a 270-degree anterior wrap through a thoracotomy incision. And then you have your Hill wrap, which is a posterior gastropexy.
Kevin, when you're talking about the Nissen is really what we're talking about. The Nissen is the one that's most widely performed. It's the one we often talk about, unless there's a reason to do one of the other ones. Yeah, what are the key surgical elements associated with the Nissen?
So you really need to have a good, complete dissection of the esophageal hiatus and both crura of the diaphragm. And this is high-value territory, and so this can be challenging, and if you don't know what you're doing, it can be dangerous at times. And you also, you have to have this fundus fully mobilized to be able to give yourself an adequate wrap, and so you're going to have to divide all of the short gastrics in adequately. And then you need to mobilize the esophagus into the posterior mediastinum to obtain at least 3.5 centimeters of intra-abdominal esophagus. And then you want to make sure you close the associated hiatal defect, and that's especially if most of these patients will have some degree of a hiatal hernia. So getting those crura together tightly at the end of the case is important. And with the wrap, it'll actually help keep it intra-abdominally, and it's, for some hiatal hernias, the Nissen is the treatment. And then you want to make sure the wrap is 360 degrees, it's tensionless, but one key thing to prevent any dysphagia is you want to make sure a 50 to 60 French bougie is in the stomach throughout the case. That way you're not making this too tight.
Yeah, those numbers will change a little bit depending on who you talk about. But, really the key important factors is reestablishing your GE junction within the abdomen, performing your wrap and closing your crura. Typically, you'll see anywhere from 2 to 4 centimeters of an intra-abdominal esophagus you need to establish, and the wrap anywhere from about 2 to 3, the Nissen wrap itself anywhere about 2 to 3 centimeters. John, what, often asked question is, you do all that, you're mobilizing, you do your high mediastinal mobilization of your esophagus, but you just can't get enough length on the esophagus. What's a procedure you can do, an esophageal lengthening procedure?
Yeah, this is another great abside question. A callous gastroplasty would be our answer. You know, this lengthens the esophagus by forming essentially a gastric tube along the lesser curvature using a stapler device.
So, Kevin, real quick, some of the more common postoperative complications that you run into with this and that you see pretty frequently.
So very commonly, almost a majority of your patients will have some dysphagia. Most of it's transient the first couple of days, first few weeks, it'll resolve. And then postoperative nausea and retching is also very common. It should be treated aggressively because the retching can cause breakdown of your recently placed fundoplication.
Yeah, very important to control nausea. Most of these patients you want to put on a scheduled antiemetic after the operation to avoid that. So the fear is a RAP migration or a re-herniation.
And they have to at least wait a year before they go out to Oktoberfest.
So Kevin, just to wrap up, I've heard these things about these just to wrap things up, I heard something about these magnets that you can, maybe some endoscopic...
They're not endoscopic. They're actually placed laparoscopically. Actually, a bunch of our attendings are about to be trained in it, and so they're talking about it today. And the long-term data is actually coming out for these magnets that wrap around the intra-abdominal esophagus, and it actually augments the lower esophageal sphincter. And, you know, we all thought initially, we've seen how the gastric band hasn't really played out, that these were going to erode and migrate. But they've shown the 4 and 5 year data that it's been very safe, and these patients have had very good outcomes and good quality of life. And it's an easier and less technical surgery and less dissection than a Nissen fundoplication. So though there's some cost involved with it, it's a promising procedure.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that plays out. So that does it for our opening shot. That was just a brief review of gastroesophageal reflux disease, and we'll get into a little more details of some of the different surgeries with Dr. Hunter in a little bit.
So, John, tell me, you must be German.
Yeah, Kevin, the last name McClellan is a dead giveaway.
You know, you fooled me given how excited you get every year for Oktoberfest.
I do get really excited about the Oktoberfest and all the beer gardens.
So, when and where did Oktoberfest start?
Well, Oktoberfest started in 1810 to celebrate the October 12th marriage of Bavarian Crown Prince Ludwig to the Saxon Hildburghausen Princess Therese.
Yeah, they had a big party, essentially, and they invited the whole city of Munich out into their front yard, and this was considered the first Oktoberfest. Then how did it stick around, Jason?
Yeah, so they started doing this every year, and it moved it into the city center, and it became more and more and more elaborate every year. Partygoers were initially entertained by things like tree climbing competitions, and this grew into wheelbarrow and sack races, into mush eating contests, barrel rolling races, which I don't even know what that is, and also goose chases, which I know exactly what
that
is.
Yeah, I do that every time. Yeah.
And some of the local breweries became sponsoring this, and they had beer halls and beer tents during these events.
And actually was the site of Germany's first roller coaster. One of the facts that I found interesting was I've always wondered, why is Oktoberfest in September? Well, Oktoberfest was always on the first Sunday of October. Well, when they started extending the length of Oktoberfest, they decided to extend it into September rather than to October to have good weather. And interestingly, Oktoberfest has been canceled 24 times since 1810 due to either cholera epidemics or war.
And today, Oktoberfest is the world's largest beer festival. It is held annually in Munich, Germany. This, 16-day crazy party attracts 6 million people every year who consume 1.5 million gallons of beer, 200,000 pairs of pork sausage, and 480,000 split-roasted chickens during a two-week extravaganza.
And that has been your random fact of the day.
So welcome again to everybody to another episode of Behind the Knife. We are absolutely thrilled to have Dr. John Hunter, who is the McKenzie Professor and Chair of Surgery at Oregon Health Sciences University in Portland, Oregon. And Dr. Hunter, thanks so much for joining us here today.
Oh, it's really a pleasure, Scott, to be part of this.
So for those who haven't had the opportunity like we have to get to know you over time and also review your background, can you tell us a little bit about where you trained, where you came from, and how you wound up at Oregon?
Sure. I grew up in New Hampshire. In Hanover, my dad was a neurologist at Dartmouth, and I'm number 7 of 8 kids. So I learned very early the skills of negotiation in order to get anything done. So I went to Hanover High School, which is a good public school, and then went to Harvard undergrad, where I quickly learned that the pre-meds were difficult, and so I became an English major. English major has actually been a very valuable piece to my my profile, in that it really helped me learn how to write, write scientifically, as well as creatively. And the scientific writing is such a sort of barrier for so many people to succeed academically. So I once had a fellow at Emory, Ted Truss, who told me, he said, "Dr. Hunter, I learned a little bit about surgery from you, but I learned a whole lot about writing." And so that's kind of where the editorial literary side of me comes from. So I then went to medical school at Penn. Growing up in northern New England, I thought I was going to be a family doc when I entered medical school, because I wanted to live in a small town and be outdoors all the time. But when I got to Penn, I met Alden Harkin, who is now the chair of surgery in East Bay, Oakland program. But he was a cardiac surgeon at Penn at the time, and a very inspirational figure, really sort of taught me that you could be a great surgeon, be a good dad, and stay in good physical condition, which were the three things that I thought were important in life. And so I really liked the physical contact of surgery. I liked the sort of immediate rewards of surgery. I got a little bit of attention deficit disorder, and I liked seeing things mm-hmm. happen quickly and move on to the next. So it all seemed to fit with who I was. So I went out to the University of Utah from there to do my residency. And again, Utah was an interesting choice. I wanted to go out west, and Alden Harkin told me that Frank Moody had a wonderful program in Utah, and I stopped there, and the program was good, and the skiing was great. So I threw my hat in Utah, and it was a really good choice for me. I had the chance there to meet a fellow by the name of John Dixon. And John Dixon was one of the founders of SAGES. And what John Dixon saw was that if you could do surgery with a scope, that was going to be better than doing it through a large incision, especially if you could get equivalent outcomes. So I was, even before laparoscopy, I was very interested in surgical endoscopy and sort of the principles and concepts of minimally invasive surgery were there from the beginning. So I was in stayed on at faculty in Utah, again, to do surgical endoscopy after learning flexible endoscopy at Mass General and ERCP in Canada. It was hard to look at ERCP training in the U.S., but we were able to go to Canada to work with a fellow by the name of Ron Passy, who was at Western Ontario at the time. But anyway, so we came back to Utah and stayed there for about 4 years, then went on to Emory in Atlanta, where I was for 9 years. And then 14 years ago, I got the opportunity to come back to Oregon to be the chair of surgery, and I've been here ever since.
Sir, I'm currently reading a book titled The Knife Man, and it's about one of our surgical forefathers who really brought the scientific method into surgery. What is it like being having the same name as him, John Hunter? Is this a blessing or a curse?
It's a great question. I'm actually looking at his picture right now. Like when I graduated from college, my father was approached, and so I was going to medical school. My father was approached by a vendor of some sort who had a lithograph of the Joshua Reynolds portrait of John Hunter that hangs in the Royal College of Surgeons in London, and he gave it to me as a graduation gift. And so it hung over my desk throughout medical school, and I think it probably, in some sort of subtle way, may have influenced my progress as a surgeon. But it's it really hasn't honestly made a whole lot of difference with. But I think it might have made some difference in the UK. I've got to be a little careful about this, and may regret these words in the future. I may ask you to edit them out. I'm not sure. So I was offered an honorary membership of the Royal College of Surgeons of Edinburgh. And Edinburgh, of course, is the College of Lister. And Hunter doesn't play a big role in Edinburgh at all, because he was really London-based and was originally from Glasgow, which, of course, is the rival city. And so I think in some ways it was easier for the Edinburgh folks to acknowledge to recognize me, whereas I think the London College would have a great deal of difficulty doing so, because it would seem too cute. So, but I think, in, you know, as far as being in the U.S., it's just been an inspirational individual, that's for sure. And it's a it's kind of fun to play with. When I was talking to our chair of medicine, and he told one of his colleagues that the chair of surgery in Oregon was John Hunter. They said, "Yeah, and the chair of medicine at your place is William Osler too, right?" You know.
So, Dr. Hunter, it's been very interesting to kind of go back and trace a little bit about some of your early developments in terms of laparoscopic surgery. How did you always balance in terms of being on the cutting edge versus being safe surgery? How did you do that then in the early days of like the laparoscopic cholecystectomy and then training people in that? And what are your thoughts about that now in terms of maintaining that fine balance?
So this is one of the huge sort of dilemmas and challenges. And when you have a complication, which we all inevitably have, you can't go home without asking yourself the question of whether it was your approach, i.e. laparoscopy, or whether it was just the nature of the beast that complications occur. That's especially true, of course, when you're starting out, but it never really quite goes away, I got to tell you. So I think the best answer to that question, one has to start by saying you're not going to engage on anything unless you really believe there's a benefit for the patient. And sometimes there's data, you know, sometimes there are randomized data, but often in these new things, of course, there are no randomized data. And so there has to be, you know, compelling evidence based on what you know about the pain of an incision, for instance, versus the pain of a laparoscopic port. So, you know, if you know that you can do an equivalent operation as safely, then I think it makes intuitive sense to forge ahead. Clearly, you have to tell the patient about the experience issues and how it is that you don't have a large amount of experience in the laparoscopic arena, but do in the open arena. And that's sort of how we started. I think that one of the things that distinguished me from some of my confreres was that I was willing to talk about the mistakes I made. There were a number of people who I talked with, who some of whom you might have interviewed me, who said, "Don't never talk about your complications. People don't want to hear about them." And I said, "No, in fact, that's really how you learn. You learn by talking about your complications. People do want those shared." And you know, the first of those was laparoscopic bile duct injury, and on my, I think it was 17th case or something like that, I didn't cut a bile duct, but I misidentified it, and a bile duct stricture occurred as a result of my surgery that ultimately required a hepatic jejunostomy. And that really motivated me right at that moment to say, we don't really know quite how to do this operation safely. I'd never injured a bile duct open. And so that really sent me down the road of trying to figure out how to do a safe cholecystectomy, and published an article that still remains the most highly cited article I ever published in 1992 on the subject, and really led to Steve Strasberg's critical view of safety and et cetera. And I still get asked to talk about it, and it's interesting because I don't do a lot of lap chole anymore, but I still really follow the literature and kind of understand what the issues are, I think. So it's, you know, you take that and then you move to laparoscopic Nissen and you move to laparoscopic esophagectomy. All of these things are associated with new complications that you don't foresee. You just have to be very wary, very careful. You got to have a coach. You got to have a good boss who will both allow you to innovate but also help guide you to make sure that you don't take any chances that are, you know, that could be detrimental to the patient or the institution. And I think all of these things are important.
Do you remember what it was like to be doing your first laparoscopic cholecystectomy? Can you remember back there and just saying, were you nervous? Were you guiding somebody through it? Who'd you do it with?
Yeah, that's a great question, Scott. So the way this unfolded, and again, I won't try to be too long-winded about it, but George Bursey and I worked together, and I knew George through my mentor, John Dixon, that I previously mentioned, the founder of Sages. George was having trouble in Southern California teaching lap chole because they wanted him to teach all the faculty at Cedars-Sinai before they taught anybody from anywhere else. And George's mission was to teach the academic leaders. So George called me up and said, can I move my courses to Utah? I know you teach a lot of laser courses up there, and you're probably set up to teach lap Coley courses. And, you know, I went to our animal control people and animal comparative medicine veterinarians, and they said, by all means, we can do that. And so my first course, I was also the director of that same course. And the next day, George Bursey stayed on, and we did the first lap Coley in the Intermountain West together. It was a little bit scary. I've got a picture of, I think, of one of the first ones, and every time I look at it, I wonder how he possibly did it, because the TV monitor was about a 13-inch, very old monitor with rabbit ears still on the top, and the George saw the hepatic flexure of the colon and thought the hepatic flexure was the gallbladder. And when I realized that there were no tinea on it, that there were tinea on it, I said, George, I don't think the gallbladder has tinea, at which point we found the gallbladder. So it was a little bit interesting. Yeah, but it went very well. And it wasn't until, you know, much later that we had a bile duct misidentification. But it is, you know, we've certainly come a long way since then.
Are you using the robot, and where are we right now with the robot in the future, do you see?
This is a very difficult topic for me to talk about, and it is because I've been wrong so often about it. You know, it's the old Yogi Berra, I hate to make predictions, especially about the future. because I really thought the robot was dead. I didn't think that robotic surgery was going to go anywhere because no one could prove value. It was expensive and didn't add value. And I think it's clear that it probably does add value, and it does add value in certain areas where laparoscopic surgery is particularly difficult. But I still am a little bit nonplussed to know that, you know, 15 years after the introduction of robotic surgery, there are so few randomized trials where robotic surgery is actually compared to any other kind of surgery, and that's a little bit dismaying to me. But it exists, and I certainly believe that the concern is that it would be a no different study, and that the additional cost of robotics would not be borne out. I think that it does make certain difficult operations easier. And I think robotic prostatectomy is a perfect example where urologists were having great difficulty mastering the laparoscopic prostatectomy, whereas the robotic prostatectomy, because of the addition of the wrist, made that operation easier. Certainly the tight pelvis, where it's difficult to have a very comfortable laparoscopic position to get at the left and right side of the rectum, left and the right side of the prostate, the robot can do that for you. So I have little doubt that there are applications of robotic surgery. My only worry is that the company and others will be so successful in pushing this that the skilled laparoscopic surgeon will disappear. That the skills that we've been working on and been teaching will disappear, and the cost of surgery will then go, you know, will rise accordingly, with the need to use the robot for even something as simple as a lap Coley.
So we have a lot of residents that are listening, and I get asked a lot of, I want to get involved in a journal. As a matter of fact, I want to be a chief editor of a journal like yourself at the World Journal of Surgery. I want to be a chairman of the department one day, the academic side of surgery. What advice would you give to these people in training, or people in the junior portions of their career?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. I do, and of course, as you can imagine, I do get asked that occasionally. And I think the first thing that's important is that these are honors that come along the road. They're not ends unto themselves. And so the goal of being a surgeon is to take really good care of patients, to teach others the skills that you know, to push the field, and to, you know, provide solid, high quality research. And you can't necessarily do all of those things, but you need to do some of those things. You need to do them very well. If in doing so, you prove that you have leadership skills, that you can organize the efforts around those areas, around patient care, around education, around research, people will notice. And when they notice, they'll put you in higher positions. You'll be a division chief, or you'll be a vice chair. And then from there, people around the country will notice that you've done a good job with that, and you'll be asked to submit your CV for chair positions. But if you set out at the beginning of the day that you really all you want to do is become a chair of surgery, you're likely to be frustrated. It's a great job, don't get me wrong, but still, it's the care of patients that really, you know, motivates me every morning when I get up. And I think that's what has allowed others to see that I can do this chair job reasonably well. The editor position is similar but different. The editor position came to me because I wrote a lot and I published a lot. And when the International Surgical Society was looking for a new editor-in-chief of the World Journal of Surgery, I had nothing to do with that society. I'd never been to one of their meetings. I didn't know anybody in the society. The person who called me was a Swiss surgeon from Basel. I'd never heard his name before that day. Yet they had sort of done their research and said, here's a guy that writes, that publishes, and certain other people, John Wong, Rudy Seward, Mike Saar, they'd certainly mentioned my name to the group that was making the decision. So there was no doubt that there were people who knew me that helped support that position. I had done a symposium for the World Journal years previously when Ron Tompkins was the editor, so they could look back and see that I had sort of guest editor skills and such. So some experience in the journal was definitely helpful. But again, I think it's writing, it's being willing to edit, it's being, when you're asked to be a reviewer, as a guest reviewer, say yes. You do a good guest review, you do several good guest reviews, you'll probably end up on the editorial board. And again, I'm sure that, you know, by that time I was on the editorial board of Annals and American Journal and a few other surgery and a few other good, great journals. And I think that, I'm sure, helped for them to select me as well.
Great, sir. Well, that leads us to our dissection of the day, where we have our experts take us through a clinical topic. And sir, we know you're an expert in the surgical management of gastroesophageal reflux disease, and we were hoping we could hit some of the high points of that with you today. To start it off, can you just discuss how you choose, select patients for this, and what preoperative tests are necessary before you'll consider them for surgery?
Well, I think this is, before I go there, this may be a banner day for the surgery for gastroesophageal reflux, or it may be a news item that just blows over and nobody notices. But there was a paper published in PLOS One and highlighted on NPR this morning.
I heard that.
And I haven't seen the paper because I just heard it on the radio coming in, the incidence of myocardial event, I think myocardial infarction, was 15 to 20% higher in those on PPIs than the normal population. So there is a fair amount of sort of developing worry around PPIs. So there may be a resurgence of interest in surgery. Laparoscopic surgery, especially in that laparoscopic Nissen, has achieved a reputation of creating side effects that are, in many respects, as bad or worse than the disease. So it's made people very wary of it. But having said that, I'll get back to your question, because there's no doubt that there are a lot of people who qualify, and there are a lot of people for whom life is so much better. And I'm going to digress one more time to tell you a story that I just heard like 2 days ago. So one of my patients was vacationing in Puerto Rico and got invited to the house of another fellow for dinner. And it turns out the other fellow was a patient of mine who'd undergone a laparoscopic Nissen about 20 years previously, when I was still at Emory. The patient who'd undergone the Nissen 20 years previously couldn't say enough about how his life had changed as a result of no longer having to deal with that, with gastroesophageal reflux. He said it was amazing, you know, again, through to this friend, not to me, but to the friend, or to my other patient, rather, had said, you know, this is the one health event that's really made a difference. And I think, you know, while this is anecdotal, there's lots of very good data about the quality of life benefits of laparoscopic fundoplication exceeding those of people on chronic PPIs, some of which we've contributed to, many of which other people have created. And much of this data is randomized, so it's really solid data showing the benefits of surgery. And yet the fear of side effects have been enough that has curtailed the interest. So to now finally to get to your question, the patients who should have an anti-reflux surgery are individuals who have troublesome reflux despite adequately dosed proton pump inhibitors. And troublesome is defined as reflux symptoms that are mild to moderate every day, to mild every day, or moderate to severe 2 to 3 times a week. So if I see someone who has a flare of reflux once a month, I usually will suggest that they have an endoscopy to make sure they don't have Barrett's or esophageal cancer. But then usually those patients are not as interested in surgery. Anyone who has reflux on a daily or weekly basis is much more likely to be interested. And as far as the workup of those patients, the first test is probably a proton pump inhibitor if they're not already on it, but most of them are already on it. And then that's followed by an upper endoscopy, swallow, a video esophagram, and a motility study. And the question, is often posed, why do you need to do esophageal motility? Really, there are two reasons. One is that, of course, you want to discover the unsuspected motility disorder, the achalasic, the sclerodermic, the one people who need something else other than a Nissen done. And secondarily, I think a baseline from which to compare should the patient develop dysphagia in the future is a really valuable test, really valuable information to have. As far as the 24-hour pH, this is where there's some controversy. We use this very liberally, and probably about 80% of our patients will get a 24-hour pH study. But if someone has Barrett's esophagus or erosive esophagitis and has typical symptoms of GERD, heartburn, chest pain, regurgitation, especially if they're responsive to proton pump inhibitors, it turns out you really don't need a pH study in those patients. We've looked at this and others have looked at it, and 100% of those patients who fit that profile actually have GERD. So that's probably not necessary in absolutely everybody. So I think that answered the first question. It took me about 10 minutes to do so, but there you go.
We absolutely love this story, so please keep those coming. So can you touch a little bit about Barrett's esophagus? I remember when I was a resident, low grade versus high grade, and you can wrap and progression, and then it didn't progression, then maybe it did. And this kind of gets very confusing. What are the basic breakdown components of that? And does surgical therapy help in terms of Barrett's?
So I don't think we have all the answers. That's the first thing I need to say. And of course, the older they get and the more experience you have, the less you know. So that's definitely true about Barrett's. I think that it starts with a definition, and I'll accept that this is mostly a U.S. crowd, so the U.S. definition requires the appearance of salmon-colored mucosa in the tubular esophagus and biopsy evidence of intestinal metaplasia in that portion of the esophagus. That's different from the European definition. It doesn't require the biopsy. I think without the biopsy, you're just much less specific. But with those two parameters, the risk of esophageal cancer is about 40 times higher than the background risk of anyone without Barrett's. So clearly, it's a problem. We used to feel that Barrett's needed to be scoped every year. Probably doesn't need endoscopy every year, but every 2 to 3 years at a minimum, people should have a surveillance endoscopy. If you just have Barrett's alone and have no symptoms of reflux, that's, again, somewhat controversial as to what you need to do. It's actually rare not to have any symptoms at all and have Barrett's. When you actually start asking the questions, most of these people have at least a history of reflux, of having heartburn, And I think they should be treated with either a fond application or PPIs. And there's no data that are controlled and randomized, that show that surgery, that a Nissen is better than well-dosed PPI at preventing the progression to cancer. Having said that, there are a lot of small studies and case series that do show a benefit for surgery, but again, they're not well controlled. The other problem with medical therapy is it's very difficult to get complete acid control with medical therapy. Lots of studies showing that at least 50% of people on as much as 40 to 80 milligrams of a proton pump inhibitor today, per day, still have pathologic amounts of acid in their or bile in their esophagus. So it's easy to say adequate medical therapy. It's harder to achieve it. So I think there are a lot of compelling reasons why someone with symptomatic reflux disease and Barrett should consider an operation. Then you sort of get into the dysplastic Barrett's. Low-grade dysplasia is a diagnosis where there's a great amount of inter-observer variation. That is to say that two pathologists are much more likely to read low-grade dysplasia in different ways than they are high-grade dysplasia or no dysplasia. As well, people move around from low-grade to high-grade, from low-grade to no dysplasia. People rarely move from high grade to no dysplasia. That's once you get up to high grade, you're usually there or migrating on to cancer. And then again, I guess the other pearl about Barrett's is that the field of Barrett's is a mosaic. So if you say, well, this patient had high grade and the next week I biopsy them and it was low grade, it doesn't mean that the esophagitis field got better, that there was less acid, there was less, you know, sort of progression towards cancer. It's just that you biopsied somewhere different. So again, once you have high grade, you're in a field that's very prone to progress towards cancer, and something needs to be done. Endoscopic surveillance is probably inadequate as a method of treatment of high grade dysplasia. That was favored by many people for many years. The Seattle group, Brian Reed and Doug Levine's group, and what they showed was that followed long enough, and in their case it was 8 years, that 80% of people developed invasive cancer. So just following along is sort of like watching a train heading for a building or something. I don't know. It's watching an accident waiting to happen. But so some sort of treatment is necessary. The treatment that I think is really taking off for high-grade dysplasia is the use of radiofrequency ablation. And the studies so far are really good for radiofrequency ablation in its ability to not only revert the mucosa from metaplastic to a normal squamous mucosa, but also reduce the cancer risk almost to the baseline. You have to couple this with very good acid or very good reflux control. The place that we're often asked now to get involved with these people with high-grade dysplasia is not to perform an esophagectomy, but to perform a Nissen so that the reflux can be adequately controlled for ablation to work. So it's a whole different role for surgery in high-grade dysplasia. Before I leave the topic, though, I got to say that there are quite a number of patients with high-grade dysplasia that do need an esophagectomy. And those patients are patients who have nodules that when biopsied show multifocal invasive cancer. A single small nodule can undergo EMR, maybe two small nodules. But once you get a field of nodules with invasive cancer, that esophagus ought to come out. There are also places where the esophagus is so tortuous or there's strictures that they can't really get adequate surveillance. You can't biopsy down in behind an ugly irregular stricture. And if you know there's high grade dysplasia there, you shouldn't just leave it alone and just hope it doesn't become cancer. So that, because you certainly can't treat it with RFA in some of those places. So that's a second indication. While I'm a firm believer in RFA, I also believe that a good endoscopist, whether a surgeon or a gastroenterologist, really has to always be willing to say enough's enough. Let's get this patient on to an operation.
Could you touch on what is the technique that you use most often? Is it the Nissen? And then if so, what are your indications for using some of the partial or anterior wraps?
So the Nissen is our default operation, the one we use the most frequently. The partial, posterior partial or toupee fundoplication works quite well and is favored in some parts of the world. Certainly in certain areas in Europe, they favor it because it is associated, at least early on, with less gas and bloating. It does have... In no series that's been followed long enough does the toupee have equivalent reflux control to the Nissen, so that's why the Nissen is our default operation. The place where I've kind of more recently found myself using more toupees is the elderly patient with a giant paraesophageal hernia, especially if we can document poor motility in that esophagus. Those patients... do have a higher incidence of dysphagia if you do a full fundoplication on them. So I think there is a role in those patients for partial. So I would urge, you know, our listeners not to abandon the partial fundoplication. I think it has a role, and if they used it, you know, 10 to 25% of the time, that would be probably about the right amount. Anterior fundoplication I use when I perform a Heller myotomy for achalasia. I rarely use an anterior fundoplication alone, mostly because it's probably not quite as good a barrier as the posterior 270, and also the hiatal closure, which is important in most of reflux patients, takes you posteriorly anyway. And so it doesn't sit quite as well.
So I'm a intern standing at your scrub tank, and I'm very interested in how you do this operation. So I turn and say, Dr. Hunter, walk me through how you like to do a Nissen fundoplication, and what are some of the technical points that I should concentrate on as I'm doing this case with you? What do you tell them besides you should have met with me before?
So I probably would tell them that just keep watch and ask a lot of questions as we go along.
Well, what am I going to see then?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So the patient is placed in a split leg position. So we use what's called a McKay bed, but there are other beds that have the split leg configuration, and it's so much ergonomically better working at the hiatus to stand between the legs. And that once you get your pneumoperitoneum established, the patient goes in a very steep reverse Trendelenburg, which is absolutely critical for getting all the colon and the small bowel and the omentum in the lower abdomen and giving you access to the upper abdomen. We use a Nathanson liver retractor which is a sort of coat hanger curve type liver retractor to show the hiatus, and we hook the Nathanson to an iron intern type of a table-mounted retractor, so no one has to stand and hold it. It's a 5-trocar technique, and first trocar is put in just a little bit above and to the left of the umbilicus, and then the other trocars are placed along the costal margin, 2 on the left and 1 on the right with the liver retractor and the epigastrium. We like to use camera holder. The one we happen to use is the Stryker camera holder called the Wingman. And that gives a very stable image and is a lot less fatiguing for the surgeon. The operation starts by lifting the liver up by retracting the epiphrenic fat pad inferiorly to reduce the hiatal hernia. And then the dissection is a dissection of the hernia sac around the crura. So you start on the either the left or right cruce, we usually start on the right, and incise the hernia sac circumferentially, and then returning the hernia sac to the abdomen. And that space in the mediastinum should be very filmy. There shouldn't really be much there. And if, then once we get fully around the esophagus, we'll put a Penrose drain around just to, and put an endo loop around the Penrose drain. And the first assistant will then grasp onto that and be retracting inferiorly for most of the rest of the case. In order to get that Penrose drain around, though, we usually have taken down the short gastrix with a harmonic scalpel first. We'd never put anything behind the esophagus without doing it under absolute direct vision. And then the next step is just making sure there's adequate esophageal length, and that involves inferior retraction on the Penrose while you mobilize up along the esophagus. You've got to make sure you identify the anterior and posterior vagi and make sure they're not injured. And we usually don't use much heat in this region for so that we don't injure the vagus nerve. So no electrosurgery, no harmonic scalpel, unless we identify a vessel. But most of it can just be done bluntly with either just teasing the tissues away, or you can even use a sponge, a Raytech sponge, and just kind of push up along the esophagus and do a pretty quick dissection of the periesophageal tissues. You need to get about 2.5 centimeters of tension-free esophagus into the abdomen. And how do you determine that? Well, you let go. You do a test closure of the diaphragm, or you can even close the diaphragm, and then you let go of the drain. And if the GE junction retracts back to the diaphragm, then your esophagus is too short. And at that point, we'll do a colus gastroplasty to lengthen. That only is necessary in about 10% of people. Most people don't need it. And as far as the diaphragmatic closure, standard mal hiatal hernias or standard hiatal hernias will just close with pledgeted interrupted sutures. We use Tychron, but Silk works fine. And then if it's a large paraesophageal hernia, we'll put a piece of Peritex mesh just at the where our highest stitch in the diaphragmatic closure is, just to provide an extra buttress. And, you know, that hasn't been tested in randomized trials, but so far in our, we've been doing this now for 4 years and have had a very low, almost insignificant reherniation rate. But I think some sort of mesh buttress is would be encouraged, and I don't think we know exactly what the right material is. And then as far as the wrap goes, I think it's important to have a dilator in the esophagus. I think the evidence would support that. We use a 56 French for women, a 60 French for men, and do a very loose, floppy 2.5 centimeter wrap around the distal esophagus. The hernia sac or an epiphrenic fat pad should be removed in most patients unless they're really thin. And then I think one of the key things that everyone forgets to talk about is the perioperative management. And it is really important to make sure that these patients have adequate nausea control. I make sure that they stay on a very liquidy diet for the first week after surgery so they don't have food become impacted. And then we actually leave them on a soft diet for the first 3 weeks for the same reason. And with that, the dysphagia rates have really gone, you know, largely gone away. And then the other thing is just the activity. The biggest, you know, Achilles heel of the Lapnissen is the reherniation of the, especially in patients who had a hiatal hernia the first time. And so I don't know that there's any ultimate way to prevent this, but a lot of the reherniations were associated with diaphragmatic stressors like lifting, coughing, vomiting, you know, constipation, pneumonia, traffic accidents, et cetera. So to the extent that you can help patients avoid things that really cause them to strain, I think there's some benefit to that.
Unfortunately, there are the patients that will have recurrent symptoms after this. How do you go about diagnosing this and the potential treatments for the recurrence?
So if people have recurrent symptoms, it's okay to give them a trial of Prilosec or other PPI, but most of the patients who have recurrent symptoms won't actually have recurrent reflux. So it is at some point necessary to test them. And our test of choice is a barium swallow. And if the barium swallow shows a herniation of the fundoplication and symptoms, we'll probably repeat the motility and the endoscopy, but then we'll go right to surgery. Again, if a PPI isn't working. And the redo surgery is really essentially the same as the first time surgery, with the exception of the fact that you really do need to take the wrap down. I certainly have seen people just try to do a little cosmetic work, such as, you know, putting another stitch in the diaphragm or pulling the wrap down the abdomen and be closing the diaphragm, but that in and of itself is inadequate. You should take it all apart and start again.
Sir, as we finish out the dissection of the day, just one last thought. You had mentioned very briefly about the future of endoscopic treatment occurred. I know I love your Yogi Berra quote. I actually used that in an article I wrote once. I think it's fantastic. But 5, 10 years from now or 15 years from now, how do you think we're going to be treating reflux?
Oh, man. I don't know. I don't know. I really don't know. I think the endoscopic, we just finished a trial with the use of the Esophyx device, which was published in Gastroenterology, in which we showed that we could do an endoscopic anti-reflux valve that was better than a PPI at controlling symptoms of regurgitation particularly, but also quality of life. So there are that technology will continue to improve. So I think that there'll be more use of endoscopic techniques. I do think that the winds are beginning to blow back our way a little bit. I'm part of a VA trial that is looking at patients with medically refractory GERD, comparing surgery to second-line agents such as baclofen and desimipramine. And while I can't really say too much about the results, the surgery is will perform better than second-line medical therapy. So I don't think the role of surgery is going to go away. And certainly for the large hiatal hernia, which is largely what we're doing today, it's going to be there. But I think there'll also be a role for patients with straightforward reflux disease that's refractory to, or people who don't want to take PPIs. There are a lot more people coming in right now talking to me about sort of pathologic fractures, calcium metabolism, and now if this paper on MIs bears out, we might see even more folks interested in a surgical solution.
Okay, so now it's time for our quick tip and trick. This is where we ask our experts to give us some helpful hints to get us out of those sticky situations. And Dr. Hunter, let's say that you're doing a laparoscopic esophagectomy and you run into mediastinal bleeding. What is your approach to this particular situation? How do you deal with the bleeding, get control, get exposure? Can you walk us just quickly through that?
Yeah, well, you know, as my friend Rich Mullen says, the best way of getting out of trouble is staying out of trouble.
Pretend Kevin's doing the case.
Okay. So are we talking? So the only place where you would have troublesome mediastinal bleeding is a transhiatal esophagectomy. But if you're doing a transthoracic, right, you would have basically stopped it as you went along. But with the transhiatal, I think that is all about indications. If you really shouldn't be doing two types of patients with a laparoscopic transhiatal. One is a patient with a mega esophagus from achalasia. Those patients have a very rich blood supply to the esophagus, and stripping the esophagus out doesn't really work without creating a large amount of bleeding. And then the other is the patient with a tumor that's in the mid esophagus that's out of your reach. There is a no man's land on a transhiatal, which is behind the tracheal bifurcation. In that area, you just can't get to it, and you depend upon sort of blunt techniques of removing the esophagus through there. Usually, we strip it out with an inversion technique. If we get bleeding, and we haven't really had any real significant bleeding, Scott, but I will just push some Raytech sponges up in the mediastinum and then go do something else for a while, and it's always stopped. We have not had to transfuse any of those patients. We've not had to do a thoracotomy on any of those patients. So that hasn't been a huge issue for us.
Great.
Fantastic. That ends our tips and tricks segment.
And now we'll go into our final five. These are our five questions we use to close out the interview to find out a little bit more about our guest. So Dr. Hunter, our first question is, do you listen to music in the operating room? And if you do, what type of music?
I love music in the operating room. I think that the operating room should be a relaxed place. You need to be able to communicate, so the volume can't be very high. And I usually just like to listen to whatever anybody else in the room likes to listen to. And I put on a blend of sort of new music from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I'll have some jazz mixed in, So I just like a wide variety of music. Country music probably doesn't get played very much in my OR, however.
Much more diverse than Dr. Steele's.
Yeah, I'm all about Tupac and Britney Spears. So number two, can you tell us any talents, hobbies, or maybe some interests that we don't know about outside of medicine?
It's interesting that you said interest, because talents would be way too far. I'm talented in very little else, but I love outdoor stuff. I've been an avid skier since I was a kid. I used to play a lot of pond hockey when I lived in a cold climate, but don't anymore. So now what I love doing is running and cycling. I try to get out at least once a weekend for a long bike ride. And I play tennis, play golf. I've recently taken up surfing, and I do stand-up paddleboarding, and I've found that I can ride small waves pretty easily. That's really fun. I like going out and hanging out with my family. I've got three kids. One is in vet school, and one is still 13 years old, and she plays volleyball. I love going watching her play volleyball. So. A lot of stuff to do.
Number three, a favorite trip or vacation that you've been on?
Well, I can answer this. And it's really not a trip or a vacation, because about 9 years ago, we had a week where I didn't have to go give a talk somewhere. And my kids were out of school, and it was winter, and it was cold and nasty in Oregon, or at least nasty, if not cold. And my wife said, let's go to Mexico. And I called up a surgeon in Mexico City who I knew very well and asked where the Mexicans went, because I wanted to go someplace a little different. And we ended up north of Puerto Vallarta in a little town called Punta Mita. And before long, we ended up buying a house there. And so my favorite vacation is really just going down to Mexico and surfing and playing golf and hanging out with my family and eating a lot of great Mexican food.
That is fantastic. We kind of similarly found out about Cabo from friends of ours, and I just love that area. Number four, if you did not go into medicine, what would have been an alternate career that you would have been doing?
Well, you never really know. I entered college thinking I was going to be an astrophysicist, but my science skills weren't really up to the level of the science skills of some of the kids I was with, and so that didn't look like that was going to be my career. I've always loved being outdoors, and just been intrigued by landscape design and wildlife photography. Now, neither of those would pay very much, although a good landscape designer, I think, does okay. But if in my retirement, that would be the thing that I think I would find most interesting.
And number five, to close it out, sir, if you could go back in time and meet yourself as an intern and give yourself one piece of advice, what piece of advice would you tell yourself?
These are great questions. There's so many pieces of advice. It's hard to pick out just one of them, because I'm thinking as I'm sort of cogitating on this, I realize that there are interns listening to this. I think engagement with the patient is really one of the most rewarding pieces of medicine. It's just getting to know them, spending some time, getting to know their family, getting to know what they like to do, to just trading stories. I have the most fun when I love medicine right now, and I love it in large part because the difficult aspects of it, making the diagnosis, figuring out how to do the operation, taking care of the post-op care and complications, those things are pretty straightforward after you've been doing it for 30 years. So when I make rounds, it's really all about just learning more about the patient, learning about what they like to do, learning about their beliefs, learning about what they've done in life. And that's a great pleasure. And if an intern ever had the time to just, finish rounds and go just sit in somebody's room and talk to them for a while, I bet they have a lot more fun as an intern and be a much better doctor for it.
That's great.
Well, Dr. Hunter, we cannot thank you enough for taking this time out of your day. I know we know how busy you are, and just kind of sharing with them your wisdom, your past, and your tips and tricks and approach to the patient with esophageal disease. But more than anything, truly appreciate you coming on. And I know I learned a lot and had a wonderful time talking to you. So thank you so much, sir. And we really hope that in the future we'll be able to have you back on.
Well, Scott, Kevin, Jason, thank you very much. It's been fun.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Sash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.